The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from Master Wu Min's Gateless Gate koan collection. Royan calls Master, the main case. Every day, Master Royan used to call out to himself, "O Master," and would answer, "Yes." "Are you awake?" he would ask. And he would answer, "Yes, I am." "Never be deceived by others, any day, any time." "No, I will not." Woman's commentary. Old Rayon himself sells and himself buys. He has a lot of masks of goblins and demons to play with. Why? Nee. A calling one, an answering one, an awake one, and one who will not be deceived by others. If you take these different appearances as really existing, you're mistaken. If, however, you would imagine, you would imitate Rayon, your understanding is like that of a fox. Poem. Those who search for the way do not realize the truth. They only know their old discriminating consciousness. This is the cause of the endless cycle of birth and death. Yet deluded people take it for the original person. This is a very well-known koan in the koan tradition of Zen. And it appears very straightforward. Calls out, answers, "Are you awake?" "Yes." "Don't be deceived." "No, I won't." Seems to very clearly point to who is the master. Well, that would be you. To be awake, to not be deceived. And that's why it's a really excellent koan. Because it's not that. It's much more. Why do we practice? I was thinking when I first came here into training, that was a question that came up a lot. Why practice? Buddhism was new, it was getting established, nobody really knew what was going on. I did not know what was going on. And it was, you know, everybody was coming in, there was very little to read, very little to know in advance. What there was to know in advance wasn't always reliable. And so teachers often, Dada Roshi, Maizumi Roshi, teachers would raise that question, sort of ask that question for us, for the student, why practice? And there are a lot of ways that that can be responded to, a lot of ways that Buddhism responds to that, to alleviate suffering, to bring forth compassion, to liberate the mind. But in a sense, it's out of devotion to everything, to all that is life. We practice out of a ground of reverence for all that is good. Seeing the many ways that human beings cause pain and confusion, and having deep faith, even before we know it to be true for ourselves, that it does not have to be this way. Otherwise, none of us would go seeking. We would just resign ourselves. To have faith before verifying that faith, that there has to be another way. To live a life of generosity, of gratitude, of wakefulness, kindness. The Buddha realized, by realizing it, that we have this within us. All of these qualities, both the qualities of a hell being and the qualities of an enlightened being. We have Buddha nature, which is potential, a sense of potential, but it's also the reality itself of an enlightened being. But, as we know, it gets dampened, clouded over by our attachments, our false views, strong emotions, habit patterns, and that's a very active, ongoing process. It's not something that just gets baked in and then you know, we're just acting out of that. It's constantly being strengthened, regenerated, reconfirmed. That's why it's difficult to practice, to shift. But there is a direct path. That's what the Buddha taught. You know, it's important to appreciate, I think, particularly this has come up in a few of the interviews, that, you know, living at this time where meditation can mean kind of whatever you want, right? It's a word that's just applied to so many different things. And that within Buddhism, meditation is a very specific understanding what it is. And what it is completely based in what the path is. And what the path is completely based in what we are seeking. And all of that arises from and can only be because of our basic nature. There's nothing theoretical about this. And so our meditation practice is breath practice, breath awareness, koan, shikantaza, visualizations, all these different practices, these fundamental practices. I mean, there are various practices that are taken up, you know, for a very specific purpose and for a very specific time. But root practices are intended to help you travel this path from the beginning as far as you want to go. And as you develop, they develop. As you become your capacity, our capacity becomes broader and deeper, the practice becomes broader and deeper. The koan is one of those ways, right? And it's a non-linear use of language. It uses language in an ordinary way to reveal something that language cannot capture. So it's a very interesting phenomena that isn't necessarily unique to the Zen and koan tradition, but the koan tradition as it developed sort of developed that, in a sense, made it very robust, complex in a way, saw the potential. And so it's using language that follows some sort of conceptual stream. We can read these words and understand them, but its point, its purpose in taking it into meditation is through the words and the meaning to actually free us of words and meaning, to awaken the mind, to, in a sense, startle the mind, to open the door into the nature of mind and being. And so we sit zazen, we develop our mindfulness, strengthen that into concentration, and we begin to discover the mind and everything that that is, which the Buddha said is the world, which is pretty much everything. Ruiyan was a 9th century, early 10th century Chinese master. There was very little known about him. In fact, this koan is one of the only things that is known, and a few recorded teachings. And so here, every day, he would call out to himself, "O Master," and he would answer, "Yes." And this calling out, this "O Master," this is not a master in terms of a master and servant, or teacher and student, parent and child. It's calling out to the one that is true, that is complete. This calling out, "O Master," contains everything. It's not returning home because it's never left home. It's not alleviating suffering because there is no suffering here. And then he responds, "Yes." "Are you awake?" he asks. He says, "Yes, I am. Awake." This is used a lot in Buddhism. And the sort of analogy of being in a dream. In a dream, we're sleeping, we're in a dream state, things become very real. And they can be trivial, they can be very profound, but they're a dream. We wake up and realize, oh, that's a dream. And Buddhism likens that in a very direct way to every waking moment, where our mind is actively involved in creating a world that we take for real by its appearance. It's said that once the Buddha, soon after his enlightenment, in fact, very soon after his enlightenment, was walking down the road, and he came upon the Brahmin Dona. And upon seeing him, this Brahmin, this Dona, saw something in this person. And he was clearly seeing a wandering ascetic, a mendicant, a person living under the sky, but he saw something extraordinary, and he said, "Who are you? Are you a deva? Are you like a god being?" And the Buddha said, "No, I am not a god being." And he said, "Are you some kind of spirit?" He said, "No, I'm no kind of spirit." He said, "Are you an ordinary being?" And the Buddha said, "No, Brahman, I can't be known by any name. Just like a red, blue, or white lotus born in the water, grows in the water, and rises up above the surface of the water and stands unsmeared by the water. In the same way, I, born in this world, grown into this world, having overcome this world, liberated from this world, live unsmeared by the world. Remember me, Brahman, as awakened." Awakened. And it's such a wonderful, simple way of expressing, because we all have that experience of waking up from sleep, waking up from distraction, waking up from any state. And that wakefulness brings us into some deeper state of alertness, attention, presence. The world returns, seems to return in more vividness. But here it's used in the most fundamental way. Not a passing thing, not a temporary thing. And so practice helps us to see that when we open our eyes, when we open our ears, we see something, we hear something, we see somebody on the street, we read a news clip, something happens. In fact, there's a whole complex that happens in that moment, that in the simplest sense is a sense of self arises and captures, right? Appropriates and then proliferates. It recognizes, it pounces, it seizes, and then it develops. What is this? What is it called? What do I know about it? What do I want to do with it? What does it mean? And that this is not a conscious choice. We're not deciding to do this. It just seems to be automatic. It doesn't seem to be a process at all. It's just an objective experience that we're having. We don't see the mind working. When we hear somebody speaking in a way that we don't agree with or that we find difficult, the practice is to watch our mind. Watch the mind right in that moment. And mind here means everything. Body, emotions, sensations, energy, breath. That's what we're developing as Zazen, that ability to be alert to the world right there on the seat. You know, I've often thought of how when we sit with the eyes open, we speak of that as cultivating alertness, which it does. Keeping the senses open so the world can flow in and out, which it does, so that when we get off the cushion, we're not sort of habituated to meditating with the eyes closed and suddenly the world is all there. So we're learning how to keep our visual sense open but not get caught. But I also think of it as we turn our attention inward, that we're not cutting anything off. And that apparent boundary between inside and outside can dissolve. So that when we are seeing something or hearing something or experiencing something in front of us, at the same moment, we can be very aware of what's happening right here. What is the world in that moment? Because if I'm completely attentive in this and I'm lost to this, then I don't know what's arising and that will be the base from what I say or do. If I'm just completely focused on what's happening here, then I can't hear you talking. And so to think about how it's a natural process to let that apparent boundary fall away. And so that's just another way of talking about a kind of duality. Do I turn my attention inward or outward? On the bodhisattva path, do I take care of myself or do I take care of you? If I'm in the present moment, then how do I think, plan for the future? Here's something that's very difficult to let go of, right? But I'm practicing non-attachment. So duality in Buddhism teaches that things come into existence, we often think of because what they are relative to their opposite. High only makes sense, can exist because of low. Right only can exist because of wrong. Short only makes sense because there's tall. But another way of thinking of it is that something exists because of what it is not. Tall is tall because it's not short. Inside is inside because it's not outside. And I think that gets a little closer to how we often respond to things. That this that I recognize may be what I embrace, what I bring into my circle, what I affirm, what affirms me, and what it is not is the outside, is the other, is the thing that I have to keep my eye on. I was thinking about this in terms of, you know, in each election, somebody wins and somebody loses. In each sports competition, in every audition, in applying for a job, in asking somebody out for a date. I don't know, do people still do that? I remember sitting by the phone when I was in high school, wanting to call somebody out and asking for the date. I pick up the phone and put it down. Pick up the phone, put it down, right? You know, getting up the nerve. Because I might win or I might lose. It might be a yes, it might be a no, right? That's the deal. I remember when I came up north and I was working in a restaurant and somebody came up and asked me out and I thought, oh my God, I can't believe it. That didn't happen when I grew up. Somebody wins and somebody loses. Somebody's on the good side, somebody's on the not good side. What do we do with ourselves as the winner? What do we do with ourselves as the loser? Is there another way? Right? That is the way the world works. But what do we do in our mind? The duality is not in the world. It's what we create. When we see something we're attracted to or not attracted to, something, someone, it has the same nature. As we do, as the Buddha, as Rayan, it is complete as is ours. It has complete potential as does ours. It has, that person has the capacity for every enlightened virtue as do we. They also have the capacity for every unenlightened virtue as do we. The untrained mind, from a Buddhist perspective, influenced by a lifetime of conditions, right, is very subject, vulnerable, susceptible to everything, right? And that's the roller coaster, right? In a way, the world, my perception of the world decides how my day is going to go, whether I'm a winner or loser, whether I'm happy or sad. And the Buddha said, there's no peace there, there's no relaxation, there's no rest. Because even on a good day, there's tomorrow. When love and hate are both absent, the way is clear and undisguised. When Rayan calls out, O Master, this is not a place of love and hate, but it is the basis of everything good. It is the wellspring of everything good that we seek. So that we can live in a world where there is right and wrong, where there's trying hard for something, caring about something, and it not succeeding, or not succeeding in the way that we hoped, where there are good and bad actors, where there's affirming life and destroying life. A student once asked Rayon, when a crown appears on the head and flowery clouds appear at the feet, what is this? When you encounter a great holy being, a crown on the head, clouds at the feet, what is that? Rayon said, a fool in manacles. And the student says, well, what about when there is no crown? And Rayon said, still in manacles. In other words, no matter how we adorn, ornament, dress up, if that's what we're depending on, if that's the basis of whether I am happy or unhappy today, of whether I am unworthy or worthy of respect, of love, then he's saying we are in manacles. Well, what if I realize that all of that has no fundamental basis? Everything is empty, right? That's my liberation. He says, no, still in manacles. That's another side. It's not complete. So then the student says, well, when one is free of having or not having a crown, then what? Rayon says, being tired after the banquet. Being attached to one side, the other side, no side. When one is free, how is it then? That's what this is about. We come in wearing a crown and having clouds around our feet. They look different, right? The crown may be tattered, it may be filled with jewels. And then we practice to free ourselves of all of that, of all that we're clinging to. And we get to the place where there's not a single thing, no inside or outside. And Rayon calls from the side, still in manacles. Keep going. So that finally, we can just simply be tired after the banquet. Layman Pong said, grasping nothing, discarding nothing, in every place, no hindrance, no conflict, this supernatural power, marvelous activity, now I can draw water and carry firewood. Now I can be weary at the end of a good day's work. Now I can be sad. Now I can be happy. Just. Think of the trees that grow in the woods. They all want to live. They all want to live. That's deep within their structure. And so they do. They grow. Everything within them that is affirming life is affirming life. Some grow tall and crowd out others. Some are small, some are tall, some are healthy, some are weak. Some live long, some live short. They are not fighting each other. I have so many books on trees because I love trees. And so most of the time, these people who talk about all kinds of miraculous aspects of trees still talk about it in terms of this tree fighting the other one for light, for water, for nutrition, duking it out. There's going to be a winner. There's going to be a loser. They are not fighting. They're not competing. They're just being. They're fulfilling themselves in their own Dharma state, in intimate interdependence with everything around them, fulfilling their basic state. They can share nutrients. We know that that's true. But that's not kindness. They're not being kind. Kindness is good, don't get me wrong. I love kindness. But they're not being kind, they're just being. When one overwhelms another and shades another tree out, they're not being mean-hearted. They don't want that other tree to wither away. Oh, Master, Rayon calling out, is just like this. But we do create heaven and hell, love and hatred. We can want to beat out the other one. We can include and exclude, put ourselves before others. That's why the Bodhisattva vow is continually We're bringing that forward to put others before ourselves. I mentioned recently, if you bring everybody else to enlightenment and then yourself, if you bring everybody to enlightenment at the same time as yourself, all good. And what the Buddha said is, within all of that, when we put ourselves above, before others, over, at others' expense, we cannot know happiness, we cannot know peace. We have to always be looking over our shoulder. This is not devotion, this is not reverence, this is not seeing all things in their completeness. And yet, you can apply for a job you really want. Other people are applying too. Right? When I was a musician, I would, audition, I would have jury trials. Somebody was going to get the job, or somebody was going to get into, placement in school or whatever. Some people weren't. That's just the nature of the deal. But what is the mind? You can be in a foot race and race because you want to beat every other piece in there and be the winner. Or you can just run for the love of running. So we have the capacity to put ourselves before everyone else, but we have the capacity to put others first, to not indulge our anger and hatred, to cultivate kindness and compassion. If that wasn't true, we would be just flat out wasting our time. That's the path of awakening from the dream. Are you awake? Yes, I am. How can he know that? How can he know that? To study the self is to be able to see our delusions. That's like, kind of the first order of business. We have to be able to see ourself arising. This thought, this emotion, this memory, this reaction, this yes, this no. It's showing us ourself, that which we think we are and have created and are invested in and are attached to. And to see all of that in peace, without conflict, without hatred, without ill will, or without pride, if what we're seeing is glorious. And to become more and more clear, to be able to see that, to be able to recognize it. Oh yeah, I know you. Oh yeah, there you are again. The mind is self-knowing. We can see clearly. Even when it feels like we're unclear, we can see that clearly. And so too, we can see what is clear. Otherwise, there would be no realization. There would be no insight if we weren't able to see clearly what can't be seen with the eyes. I spoke about it on Friday night. The Buddha recognized that as human beings, we live in a moral universe, which we not only do, but need to be able to recognize the difference between what's right and wrong, what's affirming and destructive, what's skillful and not skillful, which is often a better way of thinking about things, because it doesn't sound so absolute. Right and wrong can seem just very absolute. And so as we are on that path, we can be angry, recognize that we're angry, and that we're angry at someone. We can want to not be angry, but we are angry. So how do we hold that and not create a duality? Which one wins, which one loses? We can be angry at somebody and not want to not be angry. We can want to be angry at them and not yet want to not be angry, okay? Then how do we hold that? We can want to be kinder and more compassionate, but we can see ourselves in many instances choosing something else. To practice non-duality means to be large and spacious and to see all of that. And when we can see all of that within ourselves and hold that, we can see that in others much more easily and hold that. being able to see it is good, but it's not enough. We have to actually then respond to practice that which we're seeing. Because we are going to respond no matter what we do. Not responding is not an option. So how do we respond? What do we do next? Practice needs to be honest. And that's not as easy as it sounds. Even if it sounds easy, maybe it doesn't. Are you awake? Yes, I am. Never be deceived by others any day, any time. I will not. How can he know that he's not going to be deceived by others? How can he know that? Another translation said, through all the marvelous days of times to come, refuse the delusions of people. Yes, yes, he answers. Refuse the delusions of people. It's interesting to think about how we take on and make our own other people's delusions. Right? We're seeing a bit of that going around these days. In the same vein, we can take on the goodness, right? The enlightened qualities, the inspiring aspects of others. Dharma practice is, in essence, to not deceive, not deceive ourselves, to walk the path that is true, which means to face what is difficult to face in that non-deception. And that can, you know, in advance, that can seem overwhelming. It's like, no, I wouldn't be able to take it. I wouldn't be able to, you know, I would just like, I couldn't handle it. Not facing it is so much harder. That never ends. It takes ongoing energy and effort that it goes into not living. And one of the, I think, often unexpected, certainly in my experience, unexpected experiences that we have when we face what is difficult is lightness, joy, a sense of confidence, and a self-affirming. This practice is not about controlling. It's not about controlling ourselves or others, but it sure as hell is not passive, as those of you who are here for the weekend might have noticed. In the early days, sometimes, you know, when Buddhism was really a curiosity to many, people would come in and say, like on a morning like this, they'd come in and say, I don't really want to practice. Could I just sit in the back and watch? That would be torture, you know. Watch everybody sit for an hour and a half. And Dada would say, no tourists. No tourists here, right? Practitioners, everybody's engaged. It doesn't help you to watch somebody else practice. Maybe in a moment to be inspired, that's one thing. That's not tourism. That's being on the path. To face whatever rises without denying, without grasping. We can deeply desire enlightenment and at the same time be at peace with our delusion. When we're practicing and we see difficult things and we are not at peace, that's what's happening, right? We're having a hard time holding both at the same time. One seems to defeat the other. If I'm on the path of enlightenment and I'm facing certain aspects of my delusion, then I must not be on the path of enlightenment. And the teachings say, no, that's what it is in this moment. That's exactly what it is in this moment. We can deeply want someone we love to be happy and free of suffering and be able to face and be with them in their suffering and know that we can't take that away. We have that capacity. We can have faith in people that they possess Buddha nature, that they have inherent goodness within them, and not give up on them, even as they exhibit all kinds of negative qualities. We can do all we can to bring about a desired result, and it doesn't work out. Buddhism is a long path. And that doesn't just mean it takes a long time to disentangle ourselves. There is that. But it's a long path in the sense that it's really devoted, dedicated, committed to ultimate liberation. Ultimate liberation for everyone. In Buddhism, traditional Buddhism, that's why the teaching of rebirth is so important, right? Because if we have to get all of this done, if I have to alleviate everybody's suffering by the time that I die, you know, what am I doing sleeping at night? I don't even have time to eat, right? And that's where it can become a panic, right? But understanding the long path is really having deep faith in karma, right? And relinquishing, having a clear aspiration, a clear sense of what we're striving for, right? What is good? What would help? What would be better? And to be intelligent and smart as we can in working towards that without grasping. And that can be a hard nut to crack. It can be a hard thing to get our heads around. Why would I even bother if I wasn't attached to that goal? It's a long path. I was just listening to a part of Dr. Martin Luther King's speech. That one of those, I think it was the last speech he said, he gave. And he said, I've seen the mountaintop. I may not get there with you, but I've seen it. And we will get there. That's exactly the view of the Bodhisattva. And so then every waking minute, every good action, every good thought, every good intention, every skillful, every moment of practice can never be wasted. There's no such thing as a wasted moment, right? Because it's all having consequence. It's all moving something forward. And so he talks about these different masks that Weyan uses. A calling one, an answering one, an awake one, a one who will not be deceived. He says, don't think that these really exist, that these really exist. In other words, they're not real. They don't exist in any fundamental way. Don't get attached to them. Why does he put on these different masks? For us. Why do you put on a mother mask, a father mask, a parent mask, a kind mask? That doesn't mean they're artificial. It doesn't mean that they're false. It means they're fleeting. They're impermanent. They don't exist unto themselves. They are brought into being. It's like a dream. You can have a good dream. You can have a nightmare. You can dream yourself asleep. You can dream yourself awake. Those who search for the way do not realize the truth. They only know their old discriminating consciousness. Discriminating consciousness is the consciousness that sees, divides, names, separates, ranks, wins, loses. When we do not see the truth, that seems to be the only way the world is, the only choice we've got. It's said in Buddhism that in the beginning, samsara, living within our attachments, seems easy. Living by our desires, because you just keep following the desires. That's not hard at all, right? But practice is hard. Sitting on this cushion, bringing your attention to the breath, not being distracted, that seems really hard. But over time, samsara, living by our desires and attachment, that gets harder and harder and harder. While practice gets easier and easier. Shanti Deva said, if one person causes harm out of delusion and another gets angry with them, also out of delusion, which person is at fault? Both people are angry. Which person is at fault and which one is not? Seeing this to be the case, I should practice what is beneficial. compelled by the wish that all living beings will develop love and compassion for one another. So if I see somebody who is causing harm and I get angry at them, I'm not doing that. I'm bringing more anger and hatred into the world. I'm adding to the load. He says, if, for example, a house catches fire and there's a danger that the fire will spread to an adjacent house, it would be advisable to remove anything such as dry grass that might enable the fire to spread. What is the dry grass around our house? What are those things that easily catch fire and spread? So he says, in the same way, when those to whom I cling to with love and then they're harmed, or I cling to with anger and they're rewarded, my attachment to both of them enables the fire of anger to spread to me. So attachment, right? The love is love. But when it's attached with love, it's not love. Not the same. When I am attached to my anger, right, the fire is spreading. When there is anger arising and I practice it well, I don't suppress it, I don't deny it. There it is. But I practice it well. The fire is not spreading. So he says, my attachment to them enables the fire of anger to spread to me and to others. Feeling that this will consume me and only cause more pain and confusion, I should definitely practice to free myself of this attachment. And so I started out by saying that one way of thinking about what is the Buddhist path is about devotion and reverence. On this Thanksgiving holiday weekend, I also think of it as it's a practice of gratitude. When we sit, to be able to do that, to sit in the strength, the power, the grace, the beauty of the form of the Buddha. To be able to turn, see your mind, to turn towards what is true, to face what is difficult. We can think of that in a lot of different ways, but could we think of that as an expression of gratitude and appreciation? That with the gift of this human form, this life, this consciousness, this body, this breath, I can do that. Having encountered the Dharma, I can do that. And open a door into the unimaginable and the ordinary. So you can simply be tired after the banquet and be at rest. And when you sit down to rest and you realize, oh, there are more dirty dishes to clean, you can just clean those dishes and not add to the load of more pain and confusion. Dogen said, and I'll end with his wisdom, know that to give to yourself is a part of giving. To give to your family is also giving. Even when you give just a particle of dust, rejoice in that act, because you authentically transmit the merit of all Buddhas and begin to practice an act of a selfless bodhisattva. Just that act of giving. The mind of a sentient being is difficult to change. Remember that. The mind of a sentient being is difficult to change. Keep on changing the minds of sentient beings. From the moment you offer your first gift to the moment when everyone frees themselves and is liberated. And this is initiated by giving, by generosity, by gratitude. Dogen says, the mind is beyond measure. What you give is beyond measure. It doesn't need to be measured. And yet, in giving, the mind transforms the gift, and the gift transforms the mind. The mind and the gift transforms the receiver of that gift, and the receiver of that gift transforms the mind of the giver. That's how close we are. That's how much we depend on each other. And so for those of you here for the weekend, I hope something helpful was here for you this weekend that gives you nourishment, direction, vitality, enthusiasm for whatever path you take, for whatever direction you go. If we are going to dream, let us dream ourselves awake.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.